there are several reasons why this speaker popped out for me. First, got to find out what the Wisconsin Council of Churches was doing, Council of Churches was doing, when a colleague sent an email and said, hey, here's a project they have going on that seems like it's right up the alley of what we're trying to do at the conference. Great. It also so happens that I went to college in Wisconsin and have a great affection for the state, that had some relatives live in Wisconsin, vacationed a lot in Wisconsin as a kid. Scott is the executive director of a state-level ecumenical organization. Well, back in the early 1990s, I did a study for the Lilly Endowment on local and regional ecumenical and interreligious organizations around the country, and came to have a real heart for state level councils and conferences of churches, as at the time and probably yet today on the endangered species list of ecumenical organizations, since state level organizations are for the most part dependent creatures, or had been dependent creatures, of middle level judicatories. And it's the middle level judicatory that is the most rapidly shrinking and radically changing part of our lives, and so that therefore state councils and conferences I thought need all the help they can get. It's also the case that the project that they got involved in came after maybe coterminously with the time when Wisconsin was receiving lots of national attention. Because you remember there was these massive sit-ins in the state capitol in Madison, that there was really brutal, I wouldn't even call it legislative politics, it was just strong-arm politics going on, a real uncivil battle going on in the state legislature that at one point had a number of legislators sneaking across the state line and picking up hotel rooms in Rockford, Illinois, in order not to be present for a vote they didn't want to have to be present for, so that something couldn't pass. And I was wondering, so what is it that happened to the state that, that has the city of Milwaukee that is still about the only city in the country that's ever elected a socialist mayor? Frank Zeidler back in the middle part of the 20th century. The state of where progressive was a good word at one point in time with La Follette and Proxmire and the like. Something had happened in Wisconsin. There was the other name that is part of their project that popped out was Parker Palmer, because Parker has written this book, The Heart of Democracy, which is on the table out here. The announcement I saw was that the State Conference of Churches, Council of Churches, was trying to organize civility groups around the state to see what they could do to impact the level of conversation, the quality of conversation going on in the state. That felt like it was right down the alley of what we wanted. And when I talked to Scott Anderson about it, he said, at the time he said, we're just getting this underway. By January, I think I'm going to have something to talk to you about. Scott, we're so looking forward with what you have to talk to us about. Scott Anderson from the Wisconsin Council of Churches.
Thank you, Gary, for your invitation to be a part of this conversation. Thank you for your big Oklahoma hospitality. When I got on the airplane on Madison this morning, it was 6 below 0 and snowing. So I'm also grateful for this brief burst of spring-like weather, which is a gift to this upper Midwesterner. So thank you. In August of last year, the New York Times carried an article about my state on the front page, framed with the question that Gary just asked, in fact. So how did Wisconsin become the most politically divisive place in America? To be fair, the voters of our state had some knowledge in the fall of 2010 of our new governor, Scott Walker, and his plans to close our state's $3 billion budget gap with some drastic measures. What we weren't prepared for was his proposal to gut collective bargaining rights for state employees, the polarizing debate that followed, and a year of acrimony. Now, I'm not sure it's easy to come up with a definition of incivility, but as an eyewitness to that three-week spectacle at our state capitol, I thought of U.S. Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart, who in 1964 famously described his threshold test for pornography. He said, "I know it when I see it." Such was the case among our state's political leaders in Madison. Bad behavior all around, from Republican hubris to Democratic state senators secretly running off to undisclosed location in Illinois, to shouting matches on the floor of our state assembly that I wouldn't want any child to hear, lasting 17 hours, well beyond any previous record set by that chamber. For the cynics in the room who view politics as a form of entertainment, well, it just doesn't get any better than this. For those of us who are less cynical, Wisconsin's lawmakers became fodder for the national press and an embarrassment to a state which prides itself on being Midwest nice. 2 weeks after the demonstrations, I visited with a state representative who told me that relationships at the state capitol were so poisoned that legislators from opposing parties could not even say hello to each other in the hallways. What you may not know is that the citizenry of our state, and there are estimates of about 250,000 people who showed up on Capitol Square in Madison over a three-week period, the citizens of our state were extraordinarily well-behaved, given the tensions of the moment. When the Tea Party arrived for its counter-demonstration in the middle of it all, there were dire predictions of rioting in the streets. Nothing of the sort materialized, much to the disappointment of Fox News and CNBC. Yes, there were exceptions to this generalization. The folks who had bullhorns circling the Capitol shouting obscenities at the governor's office, some minor property damage to the Capitol itself, and a small band of left-wing ideologues who kept publicly trashing legislators and disrupting the legislative process. But for the most part, thanks to the self-discipline of the protesters and the good work of law enforcement, the demonstrations were loud but peaceful and, for the most part, civil. I heard about members of extended families who were no longer on speaking terms in congregations. I heard about the political geography of the Sunday morning coffee hour, when pro-Walker supporters gathered at one end of the social hall and the anti-Walker folks, well, they were at the other. I heard about people who stormed out of Sunday services when there was any mention of the conflict in Madison. And I heard about pastors, many, many pastors, who felt ill-equipped for the moment and as a result found it easier, well, just not to talk about it than to open up any kind of respectful dialogue. It seems like our public discourse has become more and more like having an argument with your spouse. Conflict can't be avoided in our public lives any more than we can avoid conflict with the people we love. In fact, one of the great strengths of our country is that we can express these conflicts openly. Indeed, as realist and Christian theologian Reinhold Niebuhr reminds us, politics is conflict, the confrontation between opposing interests and worldviews and the norms and the values and the way we settle our differences constructively. But just as spouses have to learn ways of settling their differences without inflicting real damage on each other in our private lives, so we have to find more constructive and more life-giving ways of handling our conflicts in the public sphere, with the company of strangers who live with us in civil society. Public discourse requires making an argument for a point of view, not having an argument, as in having a fight. When Wisconsin's religious leaders couldn't agree on Governor Walker's policy prescriptions for closing the state budget gap, there was broad consensus that the way that we were engaging these public issues were absolutely unacceptable. 39 interfaith religious leaders issued a statement widely covered in the Wisconsin press calling for a season of civility with a public commitment that the religious community would take the lead through the Wisconsin Council of Churches. This statement was eventually signed by over 500 pastors and local religious leaders throughout our state. We took our inspiration for this work from Parker Palmer, a Quaker who lives in Madison, who had just published a book, Healing the Heart of Democracy, The Courage to Create a Politics Worthy of the Human Spirit. Parker laments what he calls the politics of the brokenhearted, and his answer is to refashion our civil discourse by practicing five interlocking habits of the heart, a phrase coined by Alexis de Tocqueville, and which are deeply ingrained ways of seeing, being, and responding to life that involves our minds, our emotions, our self-images, and our concepts of meaning and purpose. Here's habit number one, an understanding that we are all in this together. Biologists, ecologists, economists, ethicists, and leaders of the great wisdom traditions have all given voice to this theme. Despite our illusions of individualism and national superiority, we humans are a profoundly interconnected species, entwined with one another and with all forms of life, as the global economic and ecological crises reveal in vivid and frightening detail. We must embrace the simple fact that we are dependent upon and accountable to one another, and that includes the stranger, the alien other, which leads to a second habit of the heart. An appreciation of the value of otherness. If it is true that we are all in this together, it is equally true that we spend most of our lives living in tribes or lifestyle enclaves or communities of sameness, and that thinking of the world in terms of us and them is one of the many limitations of the human mind. The good news is that the us and them does not have to mean us versus them. Instead, it can remind us of the ancient practice of hospitality to the stranger and give us a chance to translate it into 21st century terms. Hospitality, rightly understood, is premised on the notion that the stranger has much to teach us. It actively invites otherness into our lives to make them more expansive, including forms of otherness that utterly seem alien to us. And this leads us to the third habit of the heart, an ability to hold tension in life-giving ways. Our lives are filled with contradictions, from the gap between our aspirations and our behavior to observations and insights we cannot abide because they run counter to our convictions. If we fail to hold them creatively, we will shut down any possibility of life-giving tension in our lives. But when we allow these tensions to expand our hearts, they can open us to new understandings of ourselves and our world, enhancing our lives and allowing us to enhance the lives of others. We are imperfect and broken beings who inhabit an imperfect and broken world. The genius of the human heart, Parker argues, lies in its capacity to use these tensions to create energy and insight and new life. Making the most of these gifts requires a fourth habit of the heart, a sense of personal voice and agency. Insight and energy give rise to new life as we speak out and act out our own version of truth, while checking and correcting it against the truths of others. But many of us lack the confidence in our own voices and in our power to make a difference. We grow up in educational and religious institutions that treat us as members of an audience instead of actors in a drama. And as a result, we become adults who treat politics like a spectator sport. And yet it remains possible for us, young and old alike, to find our voices, to learn how to speak them, and to know the satisfaction that comes from contributing positive change if we have the support of a community, which leads to a fifth and final habit of the heart. Without a community, it is nearly impossible to achieve voice. It takes a village to raise a Rosa Parks. Without a community, it is nearly impossible to exercise the power of one in a way that allows power to multiply. It takes a village to translate Parks' acts of personal integrity into social change. In a mass society like ours, community rarely comes ready-made. Yet the steady companionship of kindred spirits in community can help us find the courage we need to speak and act as citizens. We all must become gardeners of community if we want democracy to flourish. Now, to help teach these habits of the heart in our season of civility work, we utilized resources from Parker Palmer's think tank, the Center for Courage and Renewal in Seattle, particularly their six-session study guide, Healing Democracy Action Circles Guide, which is available for free on their website and also on ours. Now, Parker does not describe the habits of the heart in explicitly religious terms, yet it is clear that theological principles are embedded in each one. I suggested to Parker that the Wisconsin Council of Churches write a supplemental resource framing each habit biblically and theologically for the Christian community. And then one of our partners, the Interfaith Conference of Greater Milwaukee, offered to produce similar supplements for five other faith traditions. These are all now available on our website at wichurches.org, and they are a treasure. They are a treasure. One striking feature when you read the insights from all six traditions is that clear themes emerge, suggesting that the habits of the heart are spiritual practices, and in my own tradition, central to our Christian vocation as citizens. Now, we also borrowed from Parker Palmer's two decades of work in group process and facilitation with teachers, pastors, and nonprofit leaders, creating what he calls circles of trust, which become the arena for small groups to learn, practice, and reflect upon the habits of the heart. And then also a set of facilitation skills called touch tones to enable circles of trust to be safe spaces for self-examination, deep listening, and dialogue. Touchstones like being fully present, speaking your truth, not fixing others, identifying your assumptions, and suspending judgment. So with these tools in hand, the habits of the heart, circles of trust, and the touchstones, the Council of Churches hosted four regional workshops around the state in the late summer last year, just prior to the fall presidential election season, inviting congregations to send teams of leaders for training with the hope that they would return to their places of worship and form circles of trust in the heat of the fall campaign. Here we are at a synagogue in Milwaukee for one of our regional training events. Now, a major focus of our workshops was giving people the opportunity to practice the touchstones in small groups. Here at our workshop in Neenah, Wisconsin, in the northeast sector of our state, about 100 people are being trained by one of our Center for Courage and Renewal facilitators, Barb Hummel. Now, you should know that we were absolutely overwhelmed with interest in our project. Over 420 people attended workshops, and almost 100 congregations around the state formed circles of trust during this past fall, which has been one of the most successful ventures of the Wisconsin Council of Churches in the last decade. Now, most of the circles were organized within congregations, some with several congregations in a local neighborhood coming together ecumenically, some in partnership with community groups who shared a similar interest in civility, like the League of Women Voters. And then there were a few brave congregations in small towns who had brave and gifted facilitators who invited the entire community to come to the church and join the conversation. Well, what have we learned? We're just processing that question now, but let me offer a few initial insights. First, we learned that there is a significant disconnect between the expectations of the participants in Season of Civility, the expectations people brought with them to workshops, and the really, really hard work that is required to hold tension creatively. Many people came expecting to discover some kind of magic bullet or some kind of easy fix to create dialogue between people of divergent views. Well, after almost a year of this work, I'm still wondering if there is broad commitment on the part of the religious community in going deep to build the necessary skill set and capacity for civil dialogue. Now, people also came to workshops with the hope of finding ways of bringing the other to the table for conversation with the expectation that the other is the one who needs to be changed. There was both surprise and resistance that the habits of the heart lead us to self-examination and confession as to our own complicity in Wisconsin's divisive political climate. In our big city workshops, there was far more cynicism about this work in Madison and Milwaukee, for example, an undercurrent of belief that Republicans and Democrats can't meaningfully talk to each other because most folks who live in urban and suburban contexts can so easily retreat into like-minded groups. There was a completely different and far more serious tone in our small-town workshops. People in smaller communities interact very differently. Democrats and Republicans live next door to each other, work together, go to church together. And so the character of community life requires an ability to engage civilly. Small town and rural participants were much less cynical and far more willing to give this process a try. Now, one of the things we learned was that the habits of the heart are not just about politics or just about dealing with big contentious issues. One of our workshop participants, a young father in his 30s, commented at the end of the day, "Forget about the Democrats and Republicans," he said. "I need to practice these principles with my wife." And so, as we have started to think about our next steps, we are looking more broadly at framing the habits as a way of life, not limited to politics. Here's some things we're thinking about. First of all, we need to expand the base. We've been in conversation with Edgewood College, a Catholic liberal arts school in Madison, about offering a free, massive online course statewide on the habits of the heart to invite more people in congregations and communities throughout our state into dialogue. We are looking at the possibility of some new collaborations with secular groups, most notably the League of Women Voters, and we're off to a good start with the League already. We want to offer more training for those who want to go deeper in developing their facilitation skills. For example, the Center for Courage Renewal this summer is going to be offering a 4-day training event at George Williams College in the southern part of our state, a 4-day learning lab on how to develop and facilitate circles of trust around contentious issues. And we also want to explore a pilot project or two where the tools of this work might be pressed into service to address some pressing community issue or concern. Well, Lutheran theologian Jim Gustafson speaks of congregations as communities of moral discourse. One of the chief tasks of the religious community, he said, was to provide a setting for its members to confront together the moral issues that vie for their attention in the context of a basic worldview they all share. Ultimately, the habits of the heart that religious communities practice and encourage are the real gifts we can give to American public life. In many ways, practicing these habits is more important than any consensus we might hope to achieve on any divisive issue. Gustafson was sure that promoting conversation, not necessarily agreement, was the most important contribution that religious communities can make to our civil life. And that work remains the challenge and the opportunity before us. Thank you.
One of the places the homework is getting done at Oklahoma is at Oklahoma Policy Institute, which is where David Blatt is director. I'd seen David's name before because I'm a member of the Oklahoma Center for Community and Justice, and we were using the policy updates that come out of David's organization. And then had David over for dinner and said, hey, I think David could do this. And so I emailed David, and David said, well, I'm not sure what I could contribute to how people of faith might contribute to civil discourse. And I said, how about if you could have your druthers on what people of faith were contributing to civil discourse, what might that look like? He said, I might be able to work with that. David, we're so happy to have you here and looking forward to your contribution to Remind and Renew. David Blatt. Thank you.
I am very grateful to Gary and to Phillips for this invitation. I'm a little out of my element here, but I'm very excited about this chance to be speaking with you today. As Gary mentioned, I'm director of Oklahoma Policy Institute, which is a Tulsa-based state policy think tank. We provide information, analysis, and ideas aimed at promoting the fair and adequate and fiscally responsible funding of public services and expanded opportunity for all Oklahomans. If you are not already connected with us, we would be delighted if you joined our email list. So the title of my talk is Bridging the Partisan Divide in Oklahoma. We know that American politics today is marked by a high degree of conflict and anger. The country is embroiled in heated debates on a broad range of difficult issues, from gun control and abortion to taxation and the appropriate role and size of government. In Washington, the nation's leaders seem to lurch from crisis to crisis, unable to reach agreement on party lines or solve problems until we reach the brink of catastrophe, if then. To many observers, the nation's divide seems not to be strictly or even primarily partisan, one of Republicans versus Democrats. Instead, many believe that the American people are locked in an all-out culture war, split into two polarized, antagonistic, and mutually uncomprehending societies. On the one side is red state America that is seen as clinging to gods and guns, that takes a literalist approach to the Bible, that feels that their way of life is under threat from such forces as feminism, gay marriage, Islamic fundamentalism, and the ACLU. Wish these folks a happy holidays and you're waging war on Christmas. On the other side is blue state America that is seen as ready to turn the country into a socialist welfare state, that rejects religious truths and precepts, that feels that their way of life is threatened by such forces as Christian fundamentalism, prayer in school, stay-at-home moms, and the NRA. Wish these folks a Merry Christmas, and you're shoving religion down their throats and refusing to recognize today's multicultural, pluralistic nation. Particularly during the time leading up to and following this November's presidential election, the sense that the nation has reached a disturbing and dangerous level of polarization became especially widespread. For example, former Labor Terry Robert Reich titled his election eve newspaper column, We the People and the New American Civil War. He wrote, "The vitriol is worse than I ever recall, worse than the Palin-induced smarm of 2008, worse than the Swiftboat lies of 2004, worse even than the anything-goes craziness of 2000 and its ensuing bitterness. It's almost a civil war. I know families in which close relatives are no longer speaking. A dating service says Democrats won't even consider going out with Republicans and vice versa." Immediately after President Obama's reelection, the secession petitions began to circulate. From Texas and Louisiana, from Georgia and Oklahoma, and ultimately from residents of all 50 states, almost 1 million disgruntled Americans went to the We the People website to request that their state be allowed out of the United States. The response from the so-called blue states was sayonara and don't let the gun rack hit you on the way out. Often with a dose of humor, those threatening to leave were reminded that the divorce settlement might not work to their favor. The author of one Dear Red State letter noted, "You get Texas, Oklahoma, and all the slave states. We get stem cell research and the best beaches. We get Andrew Cuomo and Elizabeth Warren. You get Bobby Jindal and Todd Akin." Remember him? "We get the Statue of Liberty. You get Opryland. We get Harvard. You get Ole Miss." Sorry, Atlee. Yet while few believe that we are on the verge of an actual civil war, or that the secession movement is much more than the fantasy of a tiny fringe, the fears about the depths of our differences are real. And there are real political and socioeconomic factors pulling us apart that go far beyond the preferences some of us have for Bill O'Reilly compared to Rachel Maddow. There is widening inequality of income and wealth, an urban and rural underclass is struggling with chronic poverty, and a shrinking, embattled middle class. There are two-tiered educational, healthcare, and criminal justice systems. There is political gerrymandering that makes congressional districts less competitive and gives greater influence to the extremists of both parties, and Supreme Court decisions that seem to ensure ever greater influence for corporations and billionaires. But does all this mean that our divisions are really so deep and unbridgeable? And in particular, are we now so divided into two warring societies that productive and meaningful discourse across the cultural and political and partisan divides separating red state America and blue state America is no longer possible? Recently, something unusual happened right here in Oklahoma that suggests that the fears are perhaps overblown. Last year, in this reddest of red states, in a state where Republicans control the governor's office, both houses of the legislature, and every statewide elected office, in a state where for Democrats the defining percentage of 2012 was not the powerful 1% or the greedy 47%, but the lonely 33% who cast their votes for Barack Obama for president, here in Oklahoma, a well-orchestrated movement to do away with the state personal income tax met with spectacular failure. Not only did the Oklahoma legislature not abolish the income tax entirely, at the end of the day, it couldn't manage to pass any income tax cut at all. I'll spend the next part of this talk providing a recap of what happened in Oklahoma and how the efforts to abolish the income tax were defeated. I'll then suggest what lessons this experience offers into the state of American politics and the opportunities for civil discourse. Oklahoma has long been seen as a fertile laboratory by conservative activists to push the cutting edge of their national agenda, because not every bad idea can start in Mississippi. This has especially been true over the past decade, as Republicans have gained increasing dominance of the state legislature and executive branch. In 2007, for example, we passed an anti-immigration bill that was seen as the toughest in the nation and served as a model for later laws in Arizona, Georgia, and Alabama that many of you will also be familiar with. Every year brings new bills to tighten restrictions on abortion, weaken restrictions on guns, limit the collective and individual rights of workers, and chip away at public education through vouchers, scholarships, and charter schools. But for national groups like Americans for Prosperity and Americans for Tax Reform, the top priority has long been to limit the size of government and reduce taxes, especially the one tax that requires more of the affluent than of ordinary families, namely the income tax. Oklahoma is already a low-tax state. If you look at state and local taxes as a share of personal income, Oklahomans pay less than all but 8 or 10 other states. We've already been through a round of major income tax cuts in the mid-2000s that reduced our top marginal rate from close to 7% to just over 5%. As a result of these tax cuts and the national recession, Oklahoma has been struggling with deep budget cuts and flat funding for the past 4 years. These cuts have had far-ranging effects on our public schools, health and social service networks, public safety, and other core government functions. And yet, Oklahoma in 2012 was seen as ripe territory for an assault on the income tax. In late 2011, the state's conservative think tank, our evil twin brothers, the Oklahoma Council of Public Affairs, released a study authored by the consulting firm of Reagan-era economist Arthur Laffer. he of the trickle-down economics theory. The study purported to show that states without an income tax have the highest rates of economic growth, and that eliminating the income tax would spur the Oklahoma economy to such a phenomenal extent that other tax revenues would soar and the state would barely have to cut funding for public services. We don't know how much Arthur Lafford was paid for his services in Oklahoma or who exactly coughed up the money. But in Kansas, Governor Sam Brownback paid Lafford at least $75,000 to reach the same conclusions. And by the way, if you're from North Carolina, Arthur Lafford is in your state now with the same report. Well, the Laffer study was pure hokum, junk economics based on anecdotes, selective use of data, and weak correlations posing as causation. But it told some people exactly what suited their pre-existing beliefs and political interests. The Laffer plan was like an ice cream diet that promises you the best way to lose weight is by eating all the ice cream you'd like. A lot of people who should have known better gobbled up the ice cream because it looked so darn delicious and came with a sticker slapped on it proclaiming won't make you fat. A half dozen Republican legislators introduced bills in 2012 based directly on the Laffer blueprint for eliminating the income tax. Then on the first day of the legislative session, Governor Mary Fallon unveiled a slightly modified version of the Laffer plan, which she claimed could phase out the income tax over a decade without requiring an increase in any other taxes or creating undue strains on public education, public safety, or public health, the ice cream diet. The governor's income tax elimination plan was to be her number one priority. And with 70% approval ratings and solid Republican majorities in both chambers, the passage of at least significant cuts to the income tax looked to everyone, supporters and critics alike, to be a slam dunk. The Wall Street Journal, whose editorial page writer just happens to be a partner in Arthur Laffer's consulting firm, curiously enough, weighed in to praise the governor's courage and leadership and to proclaim the, quote, Oklahoma looks to be in the short term the likeliest state for income tax abolition. But it didn't happen. For months, the governor, House, and Senate struggled to come up with a consensus on the right plan. Hardliners insisted on total elimination of the income tax, if not all at once, then at least over a set number of years. But moderates worried about how they were going to meet the state's obligations to pay for teachers, roads and bridges, correctional officers, and nursing home care for the poor. The Laffer blueprint had called for offsetting part of the tax revenue lost from slashing the top income tax rate by doing away with deductions, exemptions, and credits that make some income non-taxable. But specifying which tax preferences to eliminate proved tricky when it turned out that the plans would mean tax increases for such groups as seniors, veterans, military personnel, and low-income families with children. Conservatives with a genuine commitment to fiscal responsibility worried about whether it was prudent to cut taxes given the low price of natural gas, which states' revenues depend on. They paused to wonder about the threat of reduced federal funding in the coming years and asked how we could meet our long-term pension obligations if we did away with our single largest revenue source. At the same time, tax cut opponents got organized and got active. As a think tank with expertise in tax policy and a core commitment to the fair and adequate funding of public services, Oklahoma Policy Institute played a lead role in coordinating the campaign to oppose tax cuts. Working closely with national policy organizations, we challenged the findings of the Laffer study and showed that its data and conclusions were fundamentally flawed. We put out analyses that showed who exactly would pay less taxes and who would pay more under various tax cut proposals. We created a series of one-page fact sheets that showed the crucial role of the income tax for our schools, for Oklahomans with disabilities, rural Oklahoma, and others. We brought together a panel of seven of Oklahoma's leading economists and business leaders at a public forum that challenged the idea that cutting taxes was the best path for Oklahoma's economic development. To respond to the idea that we needed to be more like Texas, we put out an animated video, the Oklahoma-Texas Economy Bowl, which showed we're already winning the game, why would we steal their playbook? I thought of that one. We didn't We did not create a formal coalition or organize rallies or mass days of action at the legislature, but we made sure that a broad-based network of partner organizations were armed with the data and the arguments they needed to educate and mobilize their members to let legislators know that tax cuts were not their priority. Throughout the course of the legislative session, the once unstoppable Tax Cut Express kept losing more and more steam. To inject a sports metaphor into the mix, because this is Oklahoma and you need a sports metaphor, as the shot clock wound down toward adjournment, the presumed slam dunk turned into something more like a desperation jump shot from behind the three-point line. Just prior to the final week of session, the governor, speaker, and Senate president announced agreement on a fairly modest cut to the top income tax rate, paid for in part by doing away with some exemptions and credits. The agreement satisfied nobody, and a threatened revolt by House Republicans over the plan led to it being pulled without a vote. 24 hours before the legislative session adjourned in May, Governor Fallon bowed to the inevitable and sullenly concluded there would be no tax cut in 2012. So what lessons can we draw from Oklahoma's great tax debate of 2012? Here are four things I learned that may not be obvious if you listen to the rhetoric about a nation on the verge of the next civil war. First, voters are fairly sensible. One ordinary Republican I spoke to about the plan to do away with the income tax shook her head and said, "Well, they've got to pay for the school somehow, so you know they're just going to raise our property tax or our sales tax, and us little folks will end up paying more." A big thank you to my mother-in-law. Governor Fallon and some elected officials were ready to swallow Arthur Laffer's ice cream diet, but the voters were having none of it. Voters may believe we're faced with serious fiscal problems that required bold action, but they're not looking for easy fixes, and they know when they're being sold a bill of goods. Second lesson, the common ground on what we expect from our government may, in fact, be fairly broad. Many liberals are pretty certain that the real agenda of every Republican is the one articulated by Grover Norquist, of shrinking government to the size that it's small enough to drown in the bathtub. But when polled about the statement, "I would favor cutting funding for Oklahoma's public schools so that the savings can be passed along to taxpayers in the form of a tax cut," over 80% of all Oklahomans and over 70% of Republicans disagreed. Similar, if slightly smaller, margins of voters of both parties opposed a tax cut if it meant less funding for public safety services or roads and bridges. When speaking to Republican legislators, we found that most were broadly sympathetic to lower taxes and to tax cuts. That's what makes them Republicans in the first place. But most took very seriously their obligations to ensure that Oklahoma schools are funded well enough that public school kids get a good education, that there are enough child welfare workers to protect our most vulnerable families, and there are enough staff at correctional facilities to maintain safety. Republicans overall may believe that welfare benefits are too generous and breed dependency, but that doesn't mean that most don't sincerely believe the government has an obligation to take care of people in need. Similarly, most Democrats may believe that corporations should pay higher taxes, but that doesn't mean that most aren't sincere proponents of a free market economy. Third lesson, it's easy but dangerous to pay too much attention to those political actors who shout loudest. There's no question that political news, talk radio, and political blogs have created a ready audience for those who are most willing to take extreme positions and say outrageous, insensitive, and offensive things, especially perhaps within the conservative universe. But there's a real danger to assuming that the most bellicose voices on the other side speak for the majority of the party. In the Oklahoma tax debate, the income tax abolitionists had the catchy soundbites and the support of a well-funded PR machine. But it was the more tight-lipped legislators who turned out to have the most influence. It was they who frequently had the real experience of putting together a budget and understood the funding needs of agencies and programs. In the contest between ideologues and pragmatists, the ideologues will most always win the battle of the airwaves, but they won't necessarily win the war. And a final lesson, assume your opponents can be persuaded. The assumption that we are divided into two polarized and antagonistic camps can sometimes lead us to miss opportunities to do the hard, necessary work of advocates. After all, if the Republican agenda is really one of destroying our revenue base so as to wreck public education and ruin the Medicaid program, then little you can say or do is going to make much of a difference. But here again is where it's important to distinguish the ideologues and hardcore believers from the elected officials who really are looking to do what's best, so long as the political cost isn't too great. Back in February of last year, a lot of people told us not to waste our time fighting tax cuts because all those Republican politicians, all they believe in is cutting taxes and shrinking the size of the government, and they don't care about anything else. Fortunately, out of wisdom or naivete or sheer desperation, we chose not to believe that. Instead, we found that the right strategy was to operate from the premise that, by and large, policymakers are in fact persuadable and want to do the right thing for their constituents. When legislators heard from even a few senior citizens, childcare workers, school board members, and economic developers that abolishing the income tax wasn't their priority, they listened. When they were presented with credible data and sound arguments presented in a respectful manner, they listened. Eventually, even within the Republican caucus, most members shifted from wholehearted support for tax cuts to support only for limited cuts, provided they didn't impact funding for core services. The great Oklahoma tax debate of 2012 showed that facts do matter, but only if you're willing to do the hard work of persuading the persuadable. If you talk to political veterans at the Capitol, you'll hear different versions of the story of the failure of tax cuts in Oklahoma in 2012, ones that focus on tactical errors by the governor, or competition between the House Speaker and Senate President, or the power of special interests to block reforms. But I think the story I've told is a plausible one and connects to a hopeful understanding of the core values that continue to bind together Americans. 8 years ago, a guy with funny ears and a frightening-sounding name stood up in Boston, Massachusetts, and took aim at the idea that America is locked in a culture war, that we are fundamentally a divided, polarized nation. "Look," said the Illinois state senator, "the pundits like to slice and dice our country into red states and blue states, red states for Republicans, blue states for Democrats. But I've got news for them, too. We worship an awesome God in the blue states, and we don't like federal agents poking around in our libraries in the red states. We coach Little League in the blue states, and yes, we've got some gay friends in the red states." Perhaps the surprising outcome of this year's income tax debate in Oklahoma affirms that our differences are not so great and insurmountable, and that people who may not agree on everything can still engage in civil dialogue in the political arena. At least they can in Oklahoma. Thank you.